Deutsche Welle, World in Progress.
On this program, how the revolution in Libya has brought turmoil to Mali.
When I come from Libya problem, I come to Mali, the same problem. I don't know where I will run to hide myself and with my family.
While most countries have long banned the profession, women across India continue to do a job that's frowned upon.
There's so much improvement and progress in this world, but for us, nothing has changed. We're still in the same hell.
And how soy farmers in Paraguay struggle with the agro industry.
There are some people who have technology, who have the knowledge, and they are pushing away the others who don't have the knowledge. These people have to have a right to exist.
Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. In the past few months, the West African country of Mali has been descending into chaos. A separatist movement led by Tuareg and Islamist groups defeated the regular army in North Mali, took control of its main towns and declared the independence of the state of Azawad. The breakaway prompted a humanitarian crisis with over 200,000 people forced to flee and a coup d'etat on March the 22nd. The turmoil in the region has direct links to the conflict in Libya last year, where a violent uprising ended the regime of President Muammar Gaddafi after months of conflict. Thousands returned home to Mali during Libya's uprising, migrant workers and armed fighters who had served in Gaddafi's army. In Bamako, reporter Marine Olivier talked with both groups of returnees and explored how the conflict in Libya brought misery to Mali.
Crowding around a small TV set, a group of kids and adults burst out when their team scores. Soccer game or not, it rarely gets quiet in this family compound in Bamako. Six families, over 40 people, live in the series of small rooms built around the cluttered courtyard. In one alley stands a massive refrigerator. Demba Kone points to the only valuable thing he managed to bring from Libya last spring. For 11 years, Demba was a butcher in Gathoun, a village in southern Libya. He says there were only four butchers in town, all of them from Mali. In April 2011, as the Libyan conflict escalated, Demba sent his wife and four children to Tunisia. They then flew on to Mali. Demba stayed behind to pack up their possessions. Then one night, he says, seven armed men broke into his house and assaulted him. They stuck a knife into his arm and made him give up the $15,000 he had hidden under his roof, his all life savings. He crossed over to Niger on a pickup truck a few days later. When he finally arrived in Bamako, Demba says he had nothing left but his 7-foot-long industrial fridge.
Everyone here in Mali knew that I was away for a long time, so they all thought that he must be coming back with loads of money. That's the only problem I had when I arrived. Relatives, neighbors, they all expected something from me. I had to explain that I lost everything in one night and that I've nothing to share, nothing at all.
1 year later, Demba says he's still empty-handed. He hasn't found a job. Too many butchers here already, he explains. He says he can't even afford to buy meat for his own children. Officials say about 12,000 Malian migrant workers fled Libya last year, but the numbers are likely much higher. People like Demba, who left Libya without help from embassies or international organizations, were not registered as returnees. Umar Sidibe works with a migrants advocacy group in Bamako. He says as many as 30,000 Malians returned from Libya last year. Sidibe says migrants in Libya came from all over Mali. Every region, every ethnic group had sent some of their own to work there. What drew them to Libya, he says, was the prospect of higher paying jobs. Haruna Traoré worked for a number of Western families in Tripoli. For 10 years, he cleaned their houses, looked after their children, tended their gardens, and rarely lost his smile. proudly shows off a certificate from past employers praising his honesty and cheerfulness. His last job came with a guest house for his family of five and paid $700 a month. Haruna wired as much as $300 to his relatives back home. That's about five times the average monthly wage in Mali. Now back in Bamako, Haruna and his family live off the very relatives he used to assist.
Imagine this old woman can feed me. It's my grandmother.
Your grandmother?
It's my grandmother. I eat their food. I didn't pay any money. And they let my family stay with them. Now we stay 1 year. I will make me shame too much. Somebody can help you for once, two times, three. But forever, I never imagine one day I can be for this situation.
Their only source of income is a meager $60 a month, the combined retirement pension of Haruna's uncle and grandmother. Haruna is struggling to come up with the money to rent a proper apartment for his family, let alone pay the cost of the medical treatment his nine-month-old son needs for his heart condition. Like many other migrants who came back from Libya, he's angry at the Malian government for doing nothing to help them. But he's even more furious at Mali's authorities for giving a warmer welcome to a small, select group of returnees, those who fought for the Libyan regime, like General Mohamed Ali.
He said he's General Mohamed Ali.
General Ali is a Tuareg from Timbuktu who left Mali for Libya in the 1960s. He introduces himself as a true general. 4 decades of service in Muammar Gaddafi's army earned Ali the highest military rank and a Libyan passport. Ali says he took part in all of Gaddafi's African wars in Chad, Sudan and Angola, each time receiving a 7-figure bonus for his military skills. Ali's last stand with the Libyan uniform was for the colonel himself. He fought for Gaddafi during all the key battles in last year's uprising. When the regime finally collapsed in the fall, Ali and his Tuareg battalion returned to Mali. Speaking from Timbuktu over the phone, General Ali says Malian authorities sent 4 ministers to greet him and his group. The greeting included cash. Ali won't exactly say how much, but he says other Tuareg groups received even more.
He said the people of Kidal who brought weapons received more. He said because they were heavily armed, it's why they got more money, more funds.
An estimated 2,000 Tuaregs came back to Mali after Gaddafi's fall. Some of them carried light and heavy artillery with them. Malian authorities feared they would revive a long-standing on-and-off rebellion in North Mali, so the government lavished tens of thousands of dollars on them to appease the fighters. Amadou Wegalo works on migrants affairs at the Ministry of Malians Abroad.
Everybody knew about it. The Malian workers who were in Libya for economic reasons protested because they got nothing, and they thought that was unfair. But the financial help the Tuaregs received was political. The government was trying to appease them.
That didn't work out. Many Tuareg returnees joined the Liberation Army, MNLA, which resumed the fight against the Malian government with the help of some Islamist groups. Tuaregs attacked a military base in North Mali mid-January. By early April, they had taken control of all of North Mali's main towns and declared the independence of the Azawad state. General Ali, who's part of the Azawad Liberation Movement, says the declaration of independence was long overdue.
He said he's asking a question. Don't they have the right to independence? South Sudan, what did they get? He said they are the one who died. They are fighting, and there are people who died for freedom, for independence.
General Ali left Mali during the first major Tuareg rebellion, which broke out shortly after Mali gained independence in 1960. Over the following decades, thousands of Malian Tuaregs found refuge and a warm welcome in Libya. Muammar Gaddafi portrayed himself as a champion of the Tuaregs' cause. But then Gaddafi fell, and the Tuaregs came home. Most people in Mali say the current turmoil in their country is a direct result of the regime change in Libya. The long-standing rebellion finally achieved its goal thanks to the influx of manpower and firepower from Libya. Some call it collateral damage. Others blame NATO for failing to anticipate how disruptive the collapse of Gaddafi's 4 decades rule would be for the Sahel region. Oumar Sidibé, the advocate for Malian migrants, points out that many Africans, including the African Union, raise concerns about NATO's intervention in Libya. But he says the international community didn't listen. They wanted Gaddafi out, whatever it took, even if his fall brought chaos to the whole region. Now Mali is split in two, with no diplomatic or military solution in sight. A military coup ousted the government in Bamako in March, and the newly appointed interim president struggles to transfer power back to civilian rule. Last week in Bamako, a group of soldiers who've remained loyal to the deposed president staged a counter-coup. The attempt failed but killed at least 14 people and plunged the country into even greater uncertainty. Haruna, the family father in Bamako, says he fled the conflict in Libya last year only to find his own country sliding towards war. He echoes what many of his countrymen feel.
When I come from Libya problem, I come to Mali again, the same problem, and where I will go again, whose place I can go again. I don't know where I will run to hide myself and with my family.
Marine Olivesi, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bamako, Mali.
Still to come here on World in Progress, a report about scavengers in India who have to make a living with one of the worst jobs imaginable. But first, here's Kathleen Schuster with a look at some development news.
Judge orders investigation of human rights abuses in Zimbabwe. A South African judge has ordered prosecutors to investigate whether Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe's government committed human rights abuses. He said it would benefit Zimbabweans tortured in their homeland and South Africans determined to see their own government live up to its international responsibilities. The ruling Tuesday by High Court Judge Hans Fabricius is the first under 2002 statutes spelling out South Africa's international law obligations and a significant step for Africa. However, if the order goes ahead, it could complicate South Africa's role as the main mediator in Zimbabwe's political crisis. Sudan renews attacks on South Sudan. The AFP reported on Wednesday that Sudan launched more airstrikes against South Sudan. The attacks come after months of violent clashes between the north and south. South Sudan took most of Sudan's oil reserves when it became an independent nation last summer. Tensions escalated into a border war in March after South Sudan moved into disputed Sudanese territory. Sudan began bombing South Sudan shortly thereafter. The UN and the African Union have condemned South Sudan's movement into disputed Sudanese territories. They have also condemned the North's aerial bombardments. Australia scales back on foreign aid. Charity groups are saying Australia's plan to cut foreign aid will cost lives. World Vision says up to 200,000 people could die as a direct result. Australia's budget deficit is forecast to reach $44.4 billion. The country will save $2.9 billion over 4 years by scaling back on foreign aid. Foreign Minister Bob Carr says that, quote, funding for official development assistance will continue to grow each year. It will, however, grow at a slightly slower rate. Australia is the first major developed country to balance its budget since the financial crisis. Charity groups say the consequences will be dire for many in the Asia-Pacific region. While some European countries strive to direct 0.7% of their gross national product to international foreign assistance, most countries don't reach that level. Afghanistan is no longer the worst place for mothers. Save the Children says Afghanistan is no longer the worst place for mothers in the world, according to a new report by the NGO. Afghanistan has held the lowest spot for 2 years. It has now moved up to number 164 out of 165 countries. The charity bases its ratings on criteria such as health, nutrition, education, and economic status. Last year, Afghanistan lowered mortality rates for children and mothers. More girls are also attending schools. Save the Children moved Niger to the bottom of its list this year due to the current food crisis in the Sahel region. It ranked Norway as the best place in the world for mothers in 2012. Native peoples aim to end historic and current injustices. Leaders of the world's 370 million indigenous people are urging governments to replace laws that violate the natives' rights. They say the laws must protect the lands, resources, culture, and rights of the indigenous peoples. At the 11th session of the UN's Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, which began on Monday, indigenous leaders accused leading global powers of using old but still existing laws as a weapon to justify the exploitation and abuse of indigenous communities. They argue that the discriminatory laws date back to the 1500s. Christian settlers from Western Europe used the so-called Doctrine of Discovery to justify their claim to lands inhabited by non-Christians. Many leaders are particularly concerned about the ongoing exploitation of natural resources buried in and around Native territories worldwide without consent from the indigenous inhabitants. Azerbaijan defends its human rights record ahead of European Song Contest. 2 weeks ahead of the Eurovision Song Contest, Azerbaijan Tuesday defended its human rights record and accused, quote, jealous forces of seeking to tarnish the country's image as it prepares to host the event. Senior presidential aide Ali Hazanov said criticism of Azerbaijan was unfounded. He accused foreign media of blowing up a couple of events. Eurovision, set for May 22nd to the 26th, is an annual song contest run by the European Broadcasting Union and will be watched on television by some 100 million people. Last week, rights groups Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch accused Azerbaijan of silencing dissent and free speech ahead of Eurovision.
That was Kathleen Schuster with the development news. Some jobs are just so disgusting that most governments around the world have banned people from doing them. In India, there's one profession that just won't go away. It's called manual scavenging, and it has to be up there in the top 10 worst jobs in the world. Reporter Lakshmi Narayan visited a remote village in North India to find out what life's like for the people, mostly women, who do this work.
Newly planted fields of wheat are on either side of this dirt road leading to Mudali, a village in North India. After evading buffaloes and donkey carts, we arrive at a house right next to a pond. The walls are plastered with mud and cow manure. Inside, there are about 15 middle-aged women wearing bright red, yellow and blue traditional Indian dresses. Some local children join us too. It's a sweltering hot day, but the women are used to it. Standing in the sun, they go on chatting about life, their family and work. Like most of the villages in India, Mudali has no sewage system. And it's up to these women to go from house to house and pick up the human waste by hand every day. It's known as manual scavenging, and having such a job means they are looked down upon by the rest of Indian society.
These days, people are reluctant to clean their own children's poo, but we have to clean up others' waste.
Sunita is in her mid-30s, and she's been doing this work ever since she got married about 20 years ago. That's how people get into this profession. They are either born to a family of scavengers, or they marry into one.
There's so much improvement and progress in this world, but for us, nothing has changed. We're still in the same hell. What can we do? We're so helpless.
So many things have improved in the last 20 years. But, says Sunita, for her and her village, time has stood still. Women like Sunita do this dirty work in many villages across India. More than 1 billion people live in India, and nearly half of them don't have access to a toilet, so they are forced to answer the call of nature in nature. And some 700,000 homes don't have a toilet that's linked to a sewage system. In these so-called dry latrines, someone has to manually remove the excrement by hand. That's where these women come in.
I'm walking with a woman named Goody, and she's showing me how she does her work. My mother-in-law used to do the job and she started doing it after she got married.
Goody picks up her tools, a broom, a shovel the length of a shoebox and a basket, which she balances carefully on her head. She walks to a simple-looking one-story house set in a small courtyard. Everything here is either brick red or mud brown, and there's not a single coat of paint to be seen. Goody enters the courtyard and heads towards the corner where the latrine is. She puts her basket down and covers her face with a thin cloth. She then throws some cow manure ash over the pile of waste. It's supposed to help neutralize the strong odor, she tells me.
यहाँ से काम करते हैं अब बाहर फेंकने जाते हैं अपना ये जो भी देती हैं रोटी देती हैं नाद देती हैं जो बताया तुम हमने वो काम करते हैं
Goody says she'll dump the waste in the village landfill. She gets a small portion of food every day or a monthly salary of about 50 rupees, which is less than 1 euro for each house she services. As we move to the next house, some of Goody's friends join us. They say they do this job just so they can feed their children.
ना करेंगे तो फिर अपने बच्चों कैसे पाल लेंगे?
फिर छोटे बच्चे घर में,
हाँ? देखो उनको सोचते हैं कि भाई इसको कर आएंगे तो अपने बच्चे का पेट भर जाएगा, हाँ? इसलिए करना पड़ता है।
These women, Mudali's manual scavengers, say they are ready to leave this profession if only the government would help them.
रास्ता ही नहीं मिल रहा।
If we could somehow get a job or start some business, it'll help us break free.
There is already a program to help them, but sadly, it does not work. They are eligible for a 500,000 rupee loan from the government to start a new life. But getting the money is extremely difficult, says Bezawada Wilson.
I feel that this is the failure of the government, not the failure of the women.
Both of Wilson's parents were scavengers, and he's now an activist trying to end this practice in India.
What is this nonsense? How can somebody can ask us to clean the somebody's shit? And how we can accept that?
Wilson and his team now travel the length of the country, helping the women find alternate jobs and educating them of their rights. His team has been working in Mudali village too.
Abhi inhone bichauriyon ne hame sahara diya ki tum aage chalo, utho.
For the first time, someone is actually helping us, and we are hopeful that something good will come out of it, they tell me. For DW, I'm Lakshmi Narayan in Mudali, India.
Agriculture is our topic for last story today. Global large-scale soy production is increasingly threatening the existence of local inhabitants and farmers, particularly in parts of South America. The documentary Raising Resistance examines the international issue at a local level. Observing the conflict between small-scale farmers in Paraguay and the Brazilian soy farmers taking up land in Paraguay, a conflict which has many facets. Charlotte Lomas met up with the film's director, David Burnett, in Amsterdam.
In the village of Santa Rosa in eastern Paraguay, next to the border of Brazil, Geronimo Arevalos, a father of eight, relies on farming for his family's livelihood.
Soja, seven mana.
Soy. For me, is like a bomb.
Bomba.
Raising Resistance, which premiered in 2011, is a documentary film about a conflict between the small-scale farmers in Paraguay and the much larger Brazilian agricultural farmers who are moving to Paraguay to produce soy.
You're jumping into a very complex situation where a lot of different rationalities meet and everybody thinks he's right. And you have to find out what is the situation? What is really going on? What is the deeper process, the deeper dynamics of a conflict like this?
Juana Gonzalez, a campesina, has been feeling the ecological effects of the use of herbicides on genetically modified soy and has been watching her vegetables and animals die.
At least there was work in the past. Things were better. Then came genetically modified soy, and they didn't need workers anymore.
Soy is used mainly in feed for large-scale livestock farming, as well as in the production of biofuel. Dr. Roger Nbeachy, director of the National Institute of Food and Agriculture in the US, explains why soy has become such a huge industry globally.
If we look for a way to have more effective production of meat in animals, we look for the high protein seeds. But the most effective and by far the most productive crop is soy.
Paraguay has seen an enormous boom in production since the introduction of genetically modified soy. 80% of its soy plantations produce genetically modified crops. Valero Eichelberger is a medium-scale producer of soy and owns 150 hectares of land in Paraguay.
If you want to extend your property, there's nothing stopping you.
Once this area was a dense forest, now there is barely any forest left. While Paraguay depends economically on its production of soy, for the campesinas, the production of soy is threatening their very existence. Raising Resistance aims to capture all sides of the conflict, but given the hostile nature of the situation, Bernard says filming was at times particularly challenging.
We once had a very critical situation when a journalist has observed us. He didn't speak with us, but he wrote then an article about us, even with fictional quotes of us, telling that we are European activists who try to prove that soy is killing people directly. And this article was in the news, and the soy farmers, as we can expect, have been very puzzled by what they read, and they wanted to quit cooperation. And we could explain them that normally the news write things that are not true. And so we managed to deal with that again.
Bernard and his co-director, Bettina Borgfeld, travelled a long time before they found the subjects of their film. They had wanted to document the international issue in developing countries of the growing tension between local farmers and large-scale commodity production. With the help of a small NGO based in the city Asunción, David Bennett and his crew found the campesinas in Paraguay.
As soon as we arrived there, and as soon as we have seen all these protest tents all over the country, we decided that we will make the film in Paraguay about the conflict between soy producers and small-scale farmers.
While the documentary portrays both sides in this conflict, Bennett admits in the end he couldn't help but sympathise with the campesinos.
The intention was to go closer to every side. But in the end, yes, I had the impression that I'm observing an archaic process. There are some people who have technology, who have the knowledge, and they are pushing away the others who don't have the knowledge. The ethical impulse is to say these people have to have a right to exist, to have their dignity and to have space to survive with their families.
Since filming, Bernet says the tension between the campesinos and soy farmers has escalated.
Some small groups of especially young campesinos has become more militant. There are fights, there are more arms than at the time when we have been there, and big demonstrations. I don't know what comes out of this, but it's going to be more violent, I think.
Paraguay is but one example of a South American country undergoing rapid change from the global demand and production of soy. However, within just a few years, Paraguay has become the fourth largest exporter of genetically modified soybeans in the world. Genetically modified soy is the most profitable way to produce soy. Soy makes up 80% of all food products, meaning production is unlikely to stop anytime soon. This is Charlotte Lomas for DW in Amsterdam.
And this report wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Thanks for joining me today. We'll be back next week at the same time. Until then, if you want to listen to this week's reports again or find out more about other globalization issues, please check out our webpage at dw.de/globalization. For today, on behalf of today's studio team, Jürgen Kuhn and Nigel Tandy, I'm Anke Raspa in Bonn saying thanks for listening and goodbye.